If you can't wait a whole month for our next episode, you can join our Patreon membership for early releases and exclusive content for only $5 a month at patreon.com/transgenderschool.
And you can rent our 90-minute course, Transgender Allyship 101, where we reenact my coming out and teach you how to be a true ally to any trans person in your life at vimeo.com/ondemand/trans ally. Welcome to the Transgender School podcast, where we talk about diverse LGBTQ identities and experiences so that we can all be better allies and advocates.
I'm Bridget. My daughter Jackie came out as a transgender woman when she was 19. I was totally unprepared, but I've learned a lot since then.
When I came to terms with my identity, I realized that I needed to transition, but coming out was very stressful. Now I want to help other trans people navigate their own experiences.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the Transgender School podcast. This is episode 39. Today, we'll be talking about a recent poll and survey with data about the 2024 election and the way voters are leaning with regard to trans rights and issues. The poll and survey were commissioned by GLAAD, the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation. Both were released on March 7th, and they were conducted in late January. So Jackie will share some of the results of the survey and the poll, and we'll stop at certain points to discuss the significance of the findings.
So first, we're going to talk about the nationwide poll of registered voters. By a more than 2-to-1 margin, registered voters, likely 2024 voters, and swing voters stated that they are more motivated to oppose a candidate who speaks frequently about restricting access to healthcare and sports for transgender youth than to support that candidate. Only 22% of swing voters say that anti-trans rhetoric motivates them, and 52% say it motivates them to oppose a candidate. Even among Trump voters, we see an even split of 38% who are motivated to support a candidate based on anti-trans rhetoric and 38% who are motivated to oppose a candidate, with 24% of his supporters saying that anti-trans rhetoric does not impact their support or opposition for a candidate. Voters also expressed a clear preference that healthcare decisions for transgender youth be left to their parents, with 81% of likely voters agreeing with the statement that decisions about healthcare for transgender youth are best left to parents in consultation with physicians and mental health professionals. 83% of swing voters agreed with this statement, and even 73% of Trump supporters agreed.
So I just want to jump in here and say that we don't want to be misled by this statistic, because it seems like a large percentage of potential voters are supporting parents' rights to make decisions for their trans kids and the treatment and transition-related meds. But really, the people who are conservative, the Republicans, although they may want parents to have that right, they of course want parents to not allow their kids to transition. Yes?
Yeah, I think that's a really important caveat to this statistic. But I do think it's important because Republicans are going out of their way to pass laws that explicitly bar all transgender youth from having access to gender-affirming care. And so this would imply that a majority of voters are opposed to those types of laws, that they believe this decision should be made between a parent, a child, and their healthcare professionals. I think this also speaks to the importance of having gender-affirming healthcare professionals and all the work that's being done in the healthcare and mental health fields to educate providers about trans people, because the more providers out there who are supportive, those are clearly trusted voices, and people clearly trust a doctor over a state legislator. So I think this is not exactly what it might seem on its surface, but it is still a statistic that ultimately works in our favor. And of course, this all raises the question of why Republicans keep talking about trans people and introducing so many bills to restrict access to our healthcare, even when a majority of voters seem to oppose this. I think this goes back to 2013 when the Republican National Committee commissioned a detailed autopsy of the 2012 presidential election. The report found that the party had become ideologically constrained, communicating only to people that agreed with the Republican platform. And the report recommended the party prioritize increasing its appeal to Black, Latino, Asian, women, gay, and young voters, citing changing demographics and distrust toward the Republican Party among these groups. The common wisdom heading into the 2016 election was that Trump had undone any progress the party may have made in reaching out to these groups since 2012, particularly among LGBTQ and Latino voters. But the results were more complicated. According to exit polling, Trump performed roughly on par with Mitt Romney in 2016, winning approximately 28% of the Latino vote. Many attribute this to religion and a concerted effort by the Trump campaign to reach out to Latino conservative Christians. While Latino voter turnout held steady in 2016, Black turnout declined for the first time in 20 years from 66.6% in 2012 to 59.6% in 2016. And the prospect of electing our first woman president unfortunately failed to motivate more women to turn out in 2016 than did in 2012. All of this added up to a Trump victory, despite his deeply alienating and hostile rhetoric toward LGBTQ people, immigrants, and other marginalized groups. Trump's 2016 victory meant the 2012 autopsy was largely tossed in the dustbin of history as the Republican Party increasingly embraced nationalist, conservative, Christian rhetoric, most recently embodied by the bizarre Handmaid's Tale-esque rebuttal to Biden's State of the Union delivered by Senator Katie Britt from her kitchen, a not-so-subtle message about where the GOP believes women, even those elected to the U.S. Senate, truly belong. But 2020 flipped the script again, as Biden unseated Trump by forging a coalition of suburban voters and both non-college-educated and college-educated white voters. Biden was also ironically boosted by a declining share of baby boomer and silent generation voters compared to 2016, and a record number of voters who cast their ballots by mail in 2020. Despite Trump's apparent rejection of the 2012 autopsy, the Republican Party has actually made some not insignificant gains among non-white voters under his leadership of the party. From 2016 to 2020, Democrats' margin of victory among Latino voters decreased by 8%, in addition to a 3% decrease among Black voters and a 1% decrease among Asian voters. In fact, the only racial demographics among whom Democrats have gained electoral support are white voters at 3% and voters who identify as other at 2%.
Okay, so everybody, we know this is a lot of statistics. We just want to make sure you're informed and that you have the numbers and you know what these findings are. But Jackie, can we kind of look big picture? What does this say overall about support of non-white voters for the Democratic Party?
Overall, this says that the Democratic Party is losing support among non-white voters and the Republican Party is gaining support. That picture gets a little more complicated if you go back to 2012. But if you go back to 2012, you'll see an even bigger decrease in Black support for Democrats than you do from 2016 to 2020. So it's a complicated picture, but things are not trending in the direction that Democrats would like them to be. And things are certainly not trending in the direction that a lot of pundits thought they would be based on Trump's rhetoric. Now, that said, it's really important to point out that a majority of white voters still support Republicans, and substantial majorities of non-white voters still support Democrats. But these recent trends still seem to defy the assumption that the GOP's increasingly hostile, anti-immigrant, anti-affirmative action, anti-LGBTQ, pro-Christian nationalist rhetoric and policies would somehow boost support among non-college educated white voters while costing the party support among non-white voters. That's not what we actually saw happen.
So does this mean that Republicans' current strategy appears to be costing them support among non-college educated white voters?
It's a good question, and it's hard to say exactly how much of that is Republicans' current strategy versus the increased appeal that Biden has to these groups versus Clinton, for example. But I do think that Republicans have taken what I would argue is the wrong lesson from these trends. And I think that they've seen, oh, well, we were hostile toward trans people and we're gaining support in these groups that are critical for us. And I think that that's why they can't stop talking about trans people, because they believe, evidence be damned, that their increasingly extreme messaging is working to both gin up their base and peel off support among conservative Christian voters who feel alienated by Democrats' support for trans rights. But again, you can cite evidence that cuts both ways. And I don't think it's a coincidence that Republicans lost the House in 2018, followed by the presidency in 2020, as they ramped up their support for anti-trans policies. GLAAD's recent poll seems to back this argument up. 2024 will definitely test these trends, and the outcome will depend more on state-level demographic patterns in key swing states, which fluctuate, than these overall national trends that we're discussing. So it's really hard to predict with any reasonable level of certainty what will happen, especially at this point, more than 7 months out from the election. So this, of course, brings us back to the GLAAD poll and survey. And now we want to talk a little bit about the nationwide survey, specifically of LGBTQ adults, which was also commissioned by GLAAD. This found that 68% of LGBTQ likely voters plan to support Biden in the 2024 election. This is a significant majority, which, if compared to 2020 results, means that LGBTQ adults are Biden's second most supportive demographic group behind Black voters at 90%. For context, according to a 2020 report by the Williams Institute, there are approximately 9 million LGBTQ adults registered to vote across the U.S., which is somewhere around 80% of the total number of LGBTQ adults living in the country. While LGBTQ adults are solidly supportive of the president, the survey also found that a full 9% more LGBTQ adults supported a generic Democratic congressional candidate than President Biden. The survey also found that queer adults only ranked LGBTQ equality as their sixth most important issue in the 2024 election, behind inflation, abortion, jobs, climate change, and healthcare.
Okay, so again, a lot of statistics. Jackie, can you clarify for us, big picture, what does this say about Biden's popularity or lack of popularity among LGBTQ people?
I think it says that he's popular among queer people, and he's certainly winning a substantial majority, probably a supermajority, but that he's not as popular as a generic congressional Democrat. And that's kind of a problem for him. So it'll be really interesting to see how this plays out in the election, and to see ultimately who ends up being the future of the Democratic Party. And hopefully they will have a better relationship with LGBTQ voters than Biden does. One thing that was also really interesting from this survey is that 86% of respondents believe it is likely the next 2 years will bring a more conservative Supreme Court with lasting implications for generations if Republicans control both the White House and the Senate. 85% believe we will see more restrictions on abortion. 84% believe we will see additional legislation restricting the rights of trans children. And 82% believe we will see renewed attempts to outlaw gay marriage. One thing that, again, I find really fascinating here is that 18-point gap between LGBTQ adults who believe a Republican president and Supreme Court will harm our community for generations to come, and LGBTQ adults who plan to support President Biden. This, I think, speaks to some dissatisfaction with Biden himself, but also the importance of these more individual pocketbook-focused issues like healthcare and inflation for LGBTQ voters. And again, a skepticism that Biden will make meaningful progress on these issues during a second term. LGBTQ voters also reported significant adverse effects on their emotional well-being and sense of personal safety due to the current political environment, with 72% reporting negative impacts to their well-being as a result of political discourse. 60% of LGBTQ voters reported experiencing strained personal relationships with friends or family members over these issues. 57% fear for their family's personal safety, and 49% have experienced real-world harassment or bullying, compared to 46% who've experienced online harassment or bullying. The GLAAD survey concludes that LGBTQ voters feel the cumulative weight of divisive political rhetoric on our emotional well-being, personal safety, and the safety of their families. These factors have them ready to turn out in November and deliver support for candidates committed to safeguarding their rights, ensuring their safety, and addressing their economic well-being. Hopefully that will be enough to prevent Trump from returning to the presidency, because if he wins, this might be our last free and fair national election, an ugly end to this great experiment that would almost certainly result in unprecedented attacks on LGBTQ, undocumented, unhoused, and otherwise marginalized people. If you'd like to do your part to help secure a more democratic future in the United States, you can visit events.democrats.org for volunteer opportunities up and down the ballot near you. Again, that's events.democrats.org, because we might not get another chance at this.
Thanks for informing us, Jackie, about the findings of the survey and the poll. Any final thoughts before we wrap up?
Just can't emphasize enough the importance of this election. I'm sure we'll talk about it more before November, and we'll dive in a little bit more about kind of making the argument for Biden and why we personally believe that everyone should vote for him, especially if you live in a swing state. But again, yeah, this is going to be a really pivotal moment for democracy, for civil rights, and especially for LGBTQ people across the country.
Yeah. Agreed. Thanks, Jackie. And so would you say that at this point, it'll be really important for all of us to start having conversations with friends and family? And if we know anybody in those swing states or anybody in those categories who seem unsure of which way they're going to go, but we know that they clearly would, their interests would be much better represented by Biden, that we can at least open up those conversations and hopefully do some education.
Absolutely. Have those conversations and be strategic in who you're having those conversations with. Don't have that conversation with the conservative uncle who watches Fox News every day and there's no way you're going to change his mind. But maybe have that conversation with your cousin who shows up to vote sometimes, but not every election, and is kind of on the fence and doesn't know a lot about the candidates. There's a lot of people out there who are not nearly as engaged in these issues as we and our listeners are. And so it's important for everyone listening to this to think about their own family, their own social networks, and who are those people who might be on the fence, who may or may not be planning to vote, who you can kind of nudge in the right direction.
Exactly. Thank you, Jackie. And thanks everybody for watching or listening. We'll be back next time, and we appreciate your support.
Thanks, everyone. See you next time. Thank you so much for listening to our Transgender School podcast. We hope you learned something new and that you're inspired to learn more.
If you enjoyed our conversation, please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast. And please be sure to check out our website, transgenderschool.org. You'll find many valuable resources there, including news about upcoming courses we'll be teaching.
Make sure to join us for future podcast episodes. We'll catch you on the first Tuesday of every month.